Okay, great. Okay, I'm fully mic'd up. I'm going to do that really annoying thing and sort of do that show of hands annoying thing. So just to help me understand where you're at and where I should pitch this. So hands up who would self-identify as being a meditator who has a mindfulness practice. Interesting. Hands up, not including those people who have either gone on a mindfulness class or course or have done a bit of it or tried something out. Fair amount. And then the rest. That's great. So that's super helpful. My name's Rohan Gunatilka. I, very sort of by accident, started a company that makes mindfulness-related digital products. We're based just in the other side of town in Trongate, and the company is called 21 Awake. And the product we're most known for is a product called Buddhify, which is a mobile app which teaches you mindfulness on the go. I'm not just plugging you a product, so but just to help with the context. And just as a wee thing, I'll remind you at the end, but if you email me later on and you have an iOS device, I'll send you a copy of the product so you can try it out for yourself and let me know what you think. So I'm definitely not selling to you anything. But how I got into this whole area was I've had a personal practice and interest in mindfulness since actually it was my last year at university. I sort of by accident walked into a meditation class and then just got more and more into it. And that was 12 years ago. And so over that time, I've developed a sort of a big personal interest and practice in meditation, mainly practicing personally in the Buddhist tradition, and in particular the Buddhist tradition, which is very much connected to the modern mindfulness movement, which I'll explain a bit further. And alongside my own personal interest, I've been working in sort of technology and digital stuff for ages. And the reason I came up to Scotland, I took a job with the Edinburgh Festivals as their innovation lead. So I was doing all this work, working with arts organizations, thinking about digital innovation. And then one day I decided to apply all the thinking that I was using my arts work and my consulting work to my personal life in this whole area of meditation. And that's what sort of opened up this whole idea of creating products. I spent so much time consulting and advising and producing projects for other people, I thought, why don't I just make one myself? I've learned enough to make one myself. And that's where sort of Buddhify came from. We put out a very simple prototype a couple of years ago, which got a lot of attention, and then we put out a bigger version, start of 2014, which has done really well, and basically has allowed us to sort of we've sort of ridden the growth in the interest of mindfulness that sort of Steve alluded to, and it's a crazy sort of job. I'm in this sort of weird position. So I'll sort of talk mainly around. So that's sort of my background. But I'm not going to do the whole sort of business product thing because that's a different talk. But I'm going to sort of structure the talk in three acts, I guess. The first act is just to help sort of tell the story of mindfulness from sort of the beginning to where we are today. And I think by going on that history, it really helps understand the different contexts and in which it's being used, and often some of the confusions around it as well. Then I'll talk a little bit around, like Steve said, there's been a massive boom in mindfulness research, I thought it might be interesting to actually look at that. There's a lot of hype around mindfulness right now, so I thought I'd take a bit of a different angle and talk a little about the criticisms around some of that research, which might be interesting for your work. And in particular, I think when I first met Steve, I was talking a little bit around what are the ideas that are informing the new products that we're making right now, and where are the new directions that and new areas and new frontiers that mindfulness might go. So I want to talk a bit about that. So there's sort of the three things. I'll start with a warning in that this is, like I said, this is actually the first time I've been in a lecture hall for about 13 years. And I don't really have much experience as a lecturer, so I don't actually know what I'm supposed to do, or what is the conventional way of doing things. So I'm going to do it sort of in a way that hopefully you enjoy, and it's not too awful. I've provided different version of these slides, which have references, which I know Steve's going to put up on Moodle. So there's some extra notes and links to stuff that I mentioned in there. So Act One. So brief history of mindfulness. So this is a topic that I'm really, really interested in right now. I'm actually writing a book about this. Not this, but I've just been commissioned to write a book around mindfulness in a digital culture. And the first part of the book is looking very much at the history of where it's come from. And there are sort of five or six phases or general movements which have been really important. So, mindfulness as a practice. So, just it might be helpful just to do a little mini definition bit. So, one of the sort of general issues around working in and around mindfulness is that the word is used in a lot of different ways to mean a lot of different things, and can be quite confusing. I sort of see there's three main ways in which it's used. One is to mean a very particular attentional skill, which is to be aware of whatever's happening in your experience in real time. That's for me the sort of simplest way of describing it. There's lots of different aspects of that, but just having a real-time awareness of what's happening in your body and mind at any time. The second way it's often used is actually in the context of meditation as an exercise. So about 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, people were very scared of the word meditation because it had such a hippie spiritual connotation. And so the word mindfulness was used very much more because it sounded a lot more neutral. And so often mindfulness actually is used to describe an actual meditation exercise in which you go through some techniques to develop the actual attentional skill of mindfulness. And the third way it's often used is sort of to mean anything vaguely calm or you'll see stuff. If you, as someone who works in this sort of space, everything from mindful eating to mindful sex to mindful business to mindful workplaces, the term is used in such a broad way, and in all of those contexts they're not talking about specific technical mindfulness, and so it's being used much more broadly as a sort of a general term with regards to mental well-being and recognizing one's sort of inner life as a part of mental well-being, and so that's sort of the basic definitions, I guess. And so whilst mindfulness as a training and as a skill set exists in lots of different spiritual and religious traditions, it's in Buddhism where it's really been mastered, and it's really been a real centerpiece of the tradition. And it's absolutely. And what I'm going to draw through for you just a little history, which follows one track that brought mindfulness from early Buddhism to this lecture hall. We could go into a lot of the technicalities of all the different sort of side bits, but I'll just give you sort of a brief overview for simplicity. In the early Buddhist tradition, when the Buddha himself was teaching and teaching in his monastic communities, and it was sort of emerging as a spiritual force within ancient India. Mindfulness was one of several core practices that was being taught in those by the Buddha in those communities. It was absolutely a central training, but there were also other trainings as well, such as deep concentration practices that led to absorption, practices related to kindness and gratitude and love, sort of heart-centered practices, if you like, and mindfulness as a sort of very specific training of real-time awareness. So, it was absolutely at the heart of the teaching. But it was one of a family of technique sets, I guess. And then what happened next was, basically Buddhism spread all over the place for lots of very interesting political and sort of socio-economic reasons. I'm sort of going to fast forward from prehistoric, from like ancient India to like 20th century Burma. So there's a bit of a gap between phase one and two. But really important point to note is that the history of Buddhism and the history of meditation and mindfulness meditation is actually a history of innovation and change. So as Buddhism, for whatever reason, had to move to Sri Lanka, to Thailand, to China, to Japan, to Korea, to Tibet, all these different parts of Asia, what would happen in each case, the Buddhism of a particular type would go to, for example, to China and meet the traditions of China, so Confucianism, Taoism, and the Buddhism that emerged would be forged in that particular culture. So that's why if you look at Zen, if you look at the Zen tradition in Japan in particular, it's very well known, as you all know, for like very beautiful aesthetic, very sort of clean lines, a very certain color palette. You think of blacks and browns and whites and those beautiful gardens in Kyoto. Compare that to Tibetan Buddhism, the Buddhism of the Dalai Lama and the other schools, which is incredibly colorful, incredibly ritualistic, whereas Zen is incredibly stark and direct. And these are because of the different cultures in those countries have informed these different Buddhisms. And so that's the sort of thing worth remembering as Buddhism moved and meditation moved from Asia out to the West. So mindfulness as meditation sort of, as it spread across Asia, became more or less important to different traditions. Some traditions it was quite important, some traditions not that important. But the key thing to know in this particular narrative, I guess, is that in Burma, in the 20th century, there was a renaissance in meditation practice led by a couple of monks. I guess in Asian countries, there's often a perception that, particularly Buddhist countries, there's often a perception that everyone's meditating all the time. So as someone who grew up in a sort of Sri Lankan background in London, I know Sri Lanka really well, which is a classic Buddhist country, but no one meditates. It's just not part of the fabric. It's very much a sort of social, ritual-based Buddhism. And that was also true in Burma and Thailand. But in Burma, there's a bit of a renaissance around meditation practice. And two particularly really important figures, Mahasi Sayadaw and Yubha Khin, were part of this movement of sort of popularizing meditation. And sort of two things are sort of important in the way that they approached it. One was it was very open to non-monastics taking part. So in every other country, it was very much, if you wanted to learn meditation, you pretty much had to be a monk or if you were lucky, a nun. But in Burma, there was very much a culture of a lay practice. So we had this important factor of anyone being able to learn meditation. And then, sort of accidentally at the same time, these two characters effectively invented the idea of a meditation retreat. They invented the idea of, instead of just of a sort of progressive period of time where a non-monastic could go and spend time in an intensive environment and learn meditation in quite a progressive way. And that had never really been done before until this point. And so that was a sort of quite important. And the reason it became important is that the hippies happened. So in the 60s and 70s, as you'll know, sort of there was a big movement, disillusioned movement of sort of the post-war values in the States and in Europe. And a lot of people traveled overland in an amazing route that you can no way do today, go through Iraq and Afghanistan and all these places, and traveled from the West out to India initially. Absolutely not all of them became great meditation teachers. A lot of them just, it was just like the, you know what the sort of hippie stereotype is. But what's really important for the mindfulness movement is that they were genuine in that community of people who traveled to the romantic India and Asia. There were people in there who were genuinely interested in spirituality and genuinely interested in the promise of almost the advert that, if you think of like the Beatles in the sort of the early 70s and how their relationship with the yogic traditions in India, and how that was the first real time that a mainstream, so George Harrison and John Lennon, particularly George Harrison, that whole image of being able to access a whole part of life that isn't necessarily talked a lot about in their home cultures. And it led a lot of people to explore meditation, and the modern yoga movement came out of this. So all the people who trained in the yoga movements, yoga schools in India, and then took those back to the States and to Europe, that has effectively created the yoga movement. And there were a number of key figures, but the ones I sort of call out are these particular, all American, all young American, those five. So Sharon Salzberg was 17 years old when she traveled. So they're sort of the age, they're all sort of 17 to 25 years old. The key thing was that they started training, and they went to India to sort of to discover this Eastern spirituality, and found that actually within the Indian tradition there wasn't that much meditation practice. There was a lot of yoga and a lot of service, but not a lot of actually like hardcore meditation practice. And they started looking elsewhere across Asia for that. And then that's essentially they found this Burmese tradition. And all these people started training really intensively in this particular Burmese tradition, which was absolutely all about mindfulness. Which had mindfulness at its absolute heart. And that was a sort of a key moment. And it was another really important thing is that if you think of all the development of all these different meditation schools, it was actually the first that all those schools happened independently. So if you were a Korean Zen student or teacher, you had no idea what the Tibetan tradition was like, or you had no idea what the Burmese tradition was like. But these guys, they had complete freedom of movement, and they would move from Korea to Burma to Thailand to Sri Lanka to India and learn from all these different teachers, and were sort of forging all these different ideas together. So that was a really, and then the next key thing was that the group of students and practitioners were, some of them were so gifted that they were told by their own teachers that they were good enough to then go and teach themselves. And a lot of those people stayed in Asia, but importantly, some of them came back. And when they came back, they founded meditation centers. Teaching sort of mindfulness in this Buddhist tradition, the Burmese Buddhist tradition. And the three main centers I think are worth noting are Insight Meditation Society, which is in just outside Boston in Massachusetts, Gaia House, which is in Devon, and Spirit Rock, which is in San Francisco, or just north of San Francisco in Marin County. And why this was an important movement is that it was the first time ever that you had Western teachers teaching Western students in the West. And suddenly there was a whole different language, vernacular, style. They weren't, none of these people were, they weren't monks, they weren't nuns, they were just people who were really committed practitioners and teachers. So they had suddenly, it was a very different style of environment. And then I just want to introduce this idea of unbundling. So this was the moment at which, so these teachers, they'd learned in a Buddhist tradition and they came back home. But the people they met, they weren't that interested in, the students weren't that interested in all the sort of the frills and the bits and pieces of Buddhism. The students were just passionate about the idea of meditation. They were just interested in this practice. And so meditation became unbundled from Buddhism, and this idea of unbundling is sort of quite important as we sort of go through what happened next. So the next key figure is someone you may have heard of, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a student at the Insight Meditation Society. He's based in Massachusetts. So he was training in this center in Massachusetts and learning under Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And he also happened to be a clinician and with a specialism in chronic pain, I think was his specialism that he was researching. And he just made this very, made this connection between the techniques he was learning through the insight meditation scene and his clinical work. And through that his own inquiry, he created what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was about 1979. That might not be 100% true, but you can check that in the references. And so what he started doing was teaching. He created a what's now an 8-week course for people initially with chronic pain issues, and through mindfulness classes and the encouragement to do their own daily practice, he created a system to allow people to basically give people the skills to become much more skillful in dealing with chronic pain. And that was a really interesting moment because the reason this is the second part of the unbundling is because John was when he was at Insight Meditation Center, he would be learning all the different meditation techniques, but he just honed in particularly on mindfulness as the particular meditation technique that would be most useful for this application. Not only because it was effective within the clinical context in his opinion, but also because it was they had this quite neutral attentional training style. It would be easier to convince people to do, if you think of the things like the heart-based practices or the deep concentration things, which are a bit more spiritual. So he thought, actually, the mindfulness angle is the angle that's really going to work here in the clinical context. So that was that unbundling. And it's from that point where essentially the sort of modern mindfulness movement begins in this tradition, or the idea of using it in a clinical context. The graph Steve showed was around how now the use of mindfulness-based interventions has been studied in loads and loads of different clinical applications, and I'll mention a few of those in the past. But now the phase six, I guess, which is what I sort of call the marketplace. So now, if you think about back in the day, mindfulness was effectively a spiritual practice. You only got into it if you were really interested in spirituality, self-inquiry, Buddhism, that kind of stuff. So, and then it became, through Jon Kabat-Zinn, a clinical practice, being used for stress reduction and chronic pain, all these different applications. To the point at which in 2011, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence approved mindfulness as a official accredited technique for supporting people in depression and anxiety, particularly around supporting, had really good results with regards to relapse, avoiding or minimizing the risk of relapse for depressive episodes. But now, because mindfulness is becoming more and more not only just more and more acceptable as a thing to explore, but also the scientific evidence base, both psychological and neuroscientific, is getting a lot of airtime, and that is getting a lot of people, different types of people, interested in mindfulness. And now we have completely different contexts and levels of interest in mindfulness. And so we started with spiritual, then we moved to clinical, and now it's basically fair game for everyone. The brand new applications that have appeared in the last 10 years, but the last 5 years where it's been sort of really massive, I guess, versus corporate. So the idea of mindfulness as a way of helping companies manage employee stress and boost productivity. The Hero project or the Hero example with that is a thing out of Google. Google started teaching their own employees mindfulness, and they called it Search Inside Yourself because it's a cheesy title. This idea of corporate mindfulness is now a massive market, and all sorts of companies are using it. And personally, I think it's a really, I think it's a good thing for managing stress. I think the jury's a bit out about productivity. The other new context is in performance, sort of elite performance. So as you'll probably know, those of you who are sports fans, sort of sports psychology has been a massive thing for the last 15, 20 years. But in the very recent times, we've seen mindfulness be join that group of tools. And particular, I guess, the first people who sort of started publicly talking about using mindfulness meditation to support them were people like Johnny Wilkinson, the rugby player, Rory McIlroy, the golfer, and most recently, the Seattle Seahawks, who are American football team in the Super Bowl on Sunday night against the Patriots. They won the Super Bowl last year as well, and they all go through mindfulness training. I've had some involvement in this because the Aussie Rules Football League use Buddhify as one of their sort of when new players join the league, they get given different tools, and Buddhify is one of those tools. And it's really interesting, they're using it not only to help athletes maintain a level of composure during high stress performance, but also to help athletes deal with the stress of being a celebrity sportsman, I guess. So that's a brand new context. And the other brand new context is schools and education. And we're seeing, there's a really great project called Mindfulness Schools based out of Oxford, which is essentially taking the Jon Kabat-Zinn's MBSR 8-core, 6-week model and converting it into a classroom-based process. And then you have sort of general products such as Buddhify and Headspace, which is another much more popular one than mine. So that's the brief history of mindfulness. And the key things to pull out is this idea of, as the story has developed, these whole different contexts and motivations for being interested in mindfulness have developed alongside them. And so if you're an elite golfer, that's so different to being someone who's interested in spirituality, which is so different to being someone who has a clinical anxiety problem. We have all these very different use cases. And at the moment, the actual service provision doesn't necessarily match those different types of use case, but I'll talk about that later maybe. So arguably the number one driver behind the boom in mindfulness has been the boom in clinical research in it, because it has given it the legitimacy that a bunch of guys in robes sitting on cushions don't get. For as cool as the Dalai Lama is, there's something around traditional meditation and spirituality which is considered not legitimate in the pop culture, I guess. It will always have this sort of hippie feel, but it's the science and the data which has allowed people to really get behind it. It's what's allowed the corporate sector to get really interested in mindfulness, and it's what's allowed certainly the sports group as well. And this is the same graph that Steve showed, just showing how, like, so these are the number of publications by year on mindfulness by the American Mindfulness Research Association, and the number is 549 in 2013. So there's it's just sort of going up and up. Okay, another caveat. I'm not an expert in mindfulness research, so I'm going to just represent this area a little bit. So these are the types of contexts in which mindfulness has been studied so far. They range enormously. So it started as a chronic pain thing, and it has but it's sort of developed as into all these different contexts. Everything from sort of, irritable bowel syndrome to sort of eating disorders and cancer recovery, extraordinary breadth of clinical applications. What I'm going to do is just talk about caveat some of the issues around mindfulness research. And there's a number of different aspects that I will just sort of mention briefly, and there's some really amazing references in the notes, which I'd sort of point you towards. So this first one, the first criticism is actually what we sort of talked about before, which is actually the definitions are actually really fuzzy. So one paper's definition of mindfulness isn't necessarily the same as another paper's definition of mindfulness. And that's really problematic. So that's an absolutely fundamental issue. The second one is when people are being taught mindfulness as part of a research intervention, there's quite a wide range in quality of that instruction. And also, the researchers themselves don't always have a particularly strong background in meditation practice themselves. So they'll consider something being mindfulness there'll just be a big range. So as an example, the most common proxy for expertise with regards being a meditation practitioner is hours meditated. So you'll see these graphs of like, here's an expert meditator, they've done their 10,000 hours, they've done their 5,000 hours. And I know from personal experience that sitting for 10,000 hours does not necessarily make you particularly mindful. You can do the time, but it doesn't necessarily increase your skills. And so quality is like absolutely much more important than quantity from a mindfulness perspective. And I know, again, personally and through other people, as a student, one can think that you're doing the exercises properly, but you might have fundamentally got an idea wrong or the framing wrong. So there's some real issues around what are we actually talking about. The third one, sort of a fairly common one, is that because of the nature and the cost of RCTs, they're very rarely random control trials are actually done. There are a number of different reporting scales for mindfulness, and they're generally very good, but the ease of being able to have research participants self-report means that often people actually might not be doing formal meditation or formal training at all, and they'll just be doing some pre and post self-reporting through an intervention that may not actually train someone in mindfulness, but because the mindfulness scales are being used, it's been ascribed as a mindfulness study. So that's sort of a bit problematic. Blobology is probably my favorite one. This is a term coined by a researcher at Brown University called Willoughby Britton, who's probably the most important person to look at in this space around critique of mindfulness research. And blobology is particularly to do with neuroscientific data. So she says that if you put up a chart which has a picture of a brain with bits of it lit up in different colours, people will believe anything you say. For example, here's a picture of your brain when you're texting. Here's a picture of your brain when you're engaging with your loving partner. And they're showing the same thing. Therefore, should you be worried that your relationship with your phone is as dominant as your relationship to your... These really dodgy correlative results being induced from neuroscientific data, which we don't... the neuroscientists themselves don't necessarily really understand. And it's formed this whole awful sub-industry called neuromarketing, where brands are now... brain scanning, so they'll scan their brain whilst watching adverts. So this will happen again, like Super Bowl commercials. This weekend is like the biggest advertising spend of the year on the planet, and there will have been people who would have run all those trials with people doing brain scans as a way of demonstrating what is appropriate. What is the most things that people respond to? And there's no real data and understanding of how those things work. And we have to be quite careful about how we interpret neuroscientific data. I talked already about hours versus expertise, or hours not being the same as expertise. And the final two are that... this is slightly different. So Willoughby Britton, who's the person, the researcher I mentioned, she has an expertise in what's called the dark night effect. So this is an unintended consequence of mindfulness training or meditation training. Because in traditional meditation training, if you're doing it properly and in the way, in the sort of the way that the spiritual tradition dictates, you're very likely to hit some. Actually, it's not. You're very likely to hit some difficult emotional, difficult psychological territory, and that's what's known sort of within the spiritual traditions as the dark night. And these are often not recognized as when in the hype around mindfulness, people don't always see the difficult and the dark side that can result from getting lots of people to look at their minds for a long period of time. And the other criticism is very much one that I hold, which is that if you look at that slide before, which is all these different conditions that people were looking at, the actual mindfulness intervention typically is exactly the same. It's typically an 8 to 6 week course. So there's loads of research into mindfulness in different contexts, but there's very, very, very little research into different types of mindfulness intervention, and so that is a bit of a problem. So I just want to finish this section with actually, I'm going to do that annoying thing of reading a quote out, which I hate when I'm in an audience, but because this is one of the most striking things you'll ever read, and it's very rarely referred to, but it's actually really important. This is potentially the biggest. It's a little bit out of date. It's 2007, but it's potentially the biggest. Well, it is the single biggest study into mindfulness research that ever took place by the US Department of Health. And what they said is, as a whole, firm conclusions on the effect of meditation practices in healthcare cannot be drawn based on the available evidence. And the central problem is the confusion what constitutes meditation. So there's some big problems in this literature. But what we've noticed, and that studied 813 studies. So that was like a 600-page report. And what we have to be careful for, both as sort of students and practitioners and just people sort of hearing about mindfulness, is it's the same issue of, like, that you'll see in all sorts of aspects of pop science. Is like the reporting around it can be very inflated, and we have to have a bit of a caveat and be sort of a bit very critical around actually what conclusions are being drawn. And I'm going to finish by talking about what I'm most excited about right now. So I've sort of brought ourselves from, like, done a bit of the past of meditation, a bit of the present with regards to clinical stuff, and now just talk a bit about the future and what the future might look like. So currently, the kinds of interventions that you'll see are face-to-face mindfulness-based stress reduction, face-to-face mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, that's MBCT, that's the one used in anxiety and depression. Face-to-face meditation classes in general, so non-clinical ones. As many, like, 100 books, mindfulness books, were published last year in the UK alone. And so a lot of people are engaging with it through that. And there's also a series of online classes, the Mental Health Foundation one, Being Mindful, being probably the most popular. And then there's a lot of consumer technology, such as Headspace and the products that we make as well. And what's interesting is that they are, as a digital sort of person interested in digital delivery, these are very conventional forms. So even the online courses are basically the face-to-face courses converted into video. And even the best consumer technology is dominated by guided audio as the way of delivering exercises and experiences. And all of these things work, and they work well, but as an innovation guy, I'm much more interested in, like, what are the new ways in which we can deliver this stuff? Because last week, there's an all-party parliamentary group in Westminster looking at mindfulness as a way to mindfulness in the public sector and mindfulness in public health, and they submitted their interim report last week, and it basically says mindfulness is great, we should do it more of it across the UK. But their problem is that their main mechanism is face-to-face classes, and so they'll do train-the-trainer type things where you just create cadres of teachers who are teaching 8-week courses. And that's great, but the problem is that doesn't scale. So if we generally have like a massive population in the UK that, and the world, who could value, who could get benefit from mindfulness-based interventions, just relying on face-to-face or pseudo-face-to-face interventions isn't going to solve the demand problem. And that's sort of where I see the innovation piece coming in. So just to finish off, I'll sort of talk about sort of the things that me and my company are sort of working on right now. So we take what's called a user-centered design approach to developing products. So that's in opposition to what I call a tradition-based approach. So a tradition-based approach would basically say, we do 8-week classes, and so we'll convert that into a digital course. But the problem with that is that not everyone can go to a not everyone has that amount of time to go through a course. And so user-centered design simply looks at people's lives as they actually are, how do they use technology, and try to bring mindfulness to them rather than to make the user go to mindfulness. And that's the sort of the fundamental principle of our company. Delivery model innovation, so we're now looking at, are there different ways in which people can develop mindfulness as a skill that is more than just guided audio? So guided audio is great, but it's just one form and it's not the only form. And one of the problems, one of the unintended problems of guided audio is that you can make people reliant on guided audio. You don't want to make people addicted onto a... So I can only be mindful if I listen to something. That's actually not a very skillful thing to do as a provider. Because the actual mindfulness industry is not very innovative itself as a whole, what we look at, where we go to for most of our inspiration is the games industry. That's another talk. So we're doing lots of work around sort of digital innovation. And in particular, the idea that is fundamentally sort of underpinning our next range of products is this idea of mindfulness as a multiplayer game. So traditionally we think of meditation and mindfulness as something you do by yourself in silence, in a quiet room, maybe one like this. What happens if we break all of those rules? What happens if you can develop mindfulness in a group? What if you can develop mindfulness in which people are talking out loud, or in a busy environment? And these are the new types of techniques that we're developing. And mindfulness and meditation has always been a social practice. It's always been practice in community, and so this is a very natural thing to do. And there's one particular meditation technique, if you excuse me getting a bit geeky, which is underpinning all of this. So the simplest meditation, so if I'm ever invited to actually lead a meditation class or something, the technique I always teach is this one, because it's the most simple and the most sort of different to what people expected it to be. And it's the idea of saying out loud the word which most represents what's happening in your experience right now. So I'll do it sort of myself. So pressure, interest, calm, hearing, tension, embarrassment, amusement, hearing, gratitude, calm, brightness. So a very simple idea of saying out loud this, actually just all you, just, you can't get it wrong, because even if you're confused, you just say confusion and it's right. So this idea of, yeah, this technique is incredibly interesting. It's very powerful if you just do it by yourself, but it becomes really magical when you do it in groups. So I've done lots of sessions where I've done this over Skype with friends around the world, like 6 or 7 people. I've done it in pairs many times. And this is a really powerful technique. And it's quite a playful technique. And so we're combining this idea of out loud noting, what's called social noting, with particular game mechanics, and creating a range of products all around this. And what's exciting for me about that is that because it's not what people think of as meditation, it's sort of, and therefore it will allow new audiences and new people to get the benefit of this kind of stuff. And I actually did a residency with Scottish Government this time last year, where we took this idea of social noting and playfulness to create a whole set of games called mindfulnessgames.com. You can look at the results on that out there. This idea of so the Scottish Government asked me to come up with some new ideas for mindfulness products, and the question we started with was, what would it be like if a meditation class looked less like a lecture and more like a games night? And just this whole idea of bringing more people and allowing people to relate to their inner life and their mental well-being through play. So that's a big new frontier that we're working on and other people are working on. And the biggest thing that I think we'll see in the next 3 years is actually sort of the physical devices becoming much more prevalent in this whole area of mindfulness and technology. So a lot of you will be familiar with the idea of wearables, so jawbone ups or Fitbits, and using little bits of kit. Some of you are probably wearing them right now to sort of measure your steps and your heartbeat and your galvanic skin response and all these different types of things, your movement. This area is basically saying that now that we're so used to using using technology and mobile technology to manage self-manage mental physical health. So all of us will have used sort of apps for running or at the gym or nutrition or eating or whatever. And we're now so used to that. Mobile health is now such a normal thing. But what's not normal is mobile mental health. And this is the sort of the next stage of development. And key to that will be the use of hardware. So we're seeing a big growth in... So last year, two big new products came out, which basically measure EEG, your EEG readings, your alpha, beta, delta, and theta waves. And they're relatively early, but it's the Melon and the Muse are two particular products that are worth looking at because they're the first sort of mass consumer products which are getting traction, which are literally measuring your EEG waves and using that data to help people, give people the feedback, the objective feedback to improve their attentional training. And because it's so new, like the hardware only really shipped last year, so the software suite isn't really around to sort of support it at the moment. But in the next year or so, we're going to see a lot more stuff. So I wouldn't like, although you still feels a bit wanky to be wearing like a band around your head, and but they'll become more and more acceptable as they get better designed. And the other thing is on the more sort of extreme. So that's the sort of consumer side, and on the more extreme side is what's called enlightenment engineering, and this is a movement with actually quite an active community of technologists who also happen to be very interested in contemplative practice at the sort of deep end. So if you think of more the spiritual end of things, if you think of a spiritual experience and what in the sort of in some traditions is called enlightenment or awakening, I've actually spelt that wrong, so apologies for that. There's a group of people who are making devices and technologies that will essentially put your mind and brain into an enlightenment experience. Use feedback through things like EEG to nudge you into spiritual experience. And that's quite, it's a fascinating area, but it's also fraught with danger. But it's happening. There's some really, really interesting things. And when that stuff comes out at a consumer price point, it could be quite remarkable. So just to finish off, just talk about some of the risks in this whole, what I see as the sort of the main issues and problems outside of, so just in general. One is the meditation, is the way, because mindfulness and meditation is becoming co-opted by the corporate community, there's a risk that it becomes corporatized and commodified. And it's got here through a lot of innovation and change and brilliant people doing experimental things. And there's a risk that it just gets incredibly bland and gets rolled out by Unilever as an internal well-being program. So there's that. There's the supply and demand problem I talked about before, which is face-to-face training is not going to solve the demand. And so unless we have innovation, then we're not going to, as a culture, get the most benefit out of mindfulness. the downside of having such a big progressive, big sort of growing marketplace for mindfulness is that there's big problems around quality control. So anyone can set them, anyone like me can set themselves up as a mindfulness entrepreneur and make products with no quality control, no checking. It just happened to be good fortune that I know what I'm doing, but there are lots of people who don't. And there's a problem with that, especially when we reference some of the downsides of potential downsides of long-term meditation practice without good support. And that's what I call the unintended consequences, that we don't really know what the impact. In the religious traditions, there's always a community around you to support you. Should things go wrong or you enter some difficult territory, there are people to support you that you can help get through that. And in a clinical context, there are clinicians and therapists who do that as well. But as mindfulness becomes a big pop phenomenon, we may find people entering some dark parts of their selves and their lives and not necessarily have the skills or tools to deal with it. So that's sort of the end. So I'll take some questions. Do we do questions?
Do you have any questions?
No, but my email, I'll give you my email shortly. But Sorry,
so
iOS and Android. I just can't give you a free one on Android because of how Google Play works and how annoying that is. Otherwise, I would.
What is that the results you saw through your own mindfulness and others?
Yeah, good question. It's hard to tell. I can't compare myself to myself without it. But I always say my key things are for me. The thing I noticed straight away when I first started doing it was dropping the background chatter of the mind. That was the number one thing that was like, wow, this is really interesting. That was the thread that I started pulling. So from having quite a sort of scratchy, chatty mind to that just sort of leveling out. Now the reason I keep doing it is because a number of things. One, just being able to deal with, I guess that's sort of dealing in high-pressure situations and having the skills to not only see what's going on, but to respond in a really sort of intelligent way. And then on my sort of more Buddhist, the Buddhist part of me, it gets pretty crazy when you get to the deep end of meditation practice, and it's super good fun. And when you're able to look at really, really refined, because over time, if you keep practicing, as the mind becomes more and more quiet, you're able to actually see some quite fundamental aspects of how mental processes work. So how does thinking work? How does self-identification work? How do the senses work? So all the things that you're studying, like perception and cognition, all those things are the sort of, in a sort of different way, in a sort of much more introspective way. It's fascinating. It's the reason you do psychology. That's the reason I practice meditation as well. At the back. For what, sorry?
Any sort of accreditation.
Personally?
No, overall for
mindfulness. There isn't the, I guess, the proxy accreditation for people who are teaching. So the main university in the UK who sort of does the best research and is Bangor University in North Wales. And they their sort of programs are considered the best sort of teaching graduates are coming out through that school. But then there's a flip side to that, is that because it also has this sort of spiritual Buddhist background, some of the best teachers also come through that route and don't necessarily go through the sort of more academic route. And there are others who combine the two in really beautiful ways. So, and that's one of the big problems that the all-party parliamentary group is dealing with right now, is that do they create a kite mark for mindfulness teachers, which has got some massive pros and cons to for both of them. It would mean, for example, that my product would have no legitimacy, and I'm not going to spend 2 years going through a Bangor training course when it's stuff I already know. that I've got through my own personal. So there's lots of complicated stuff in there, but it's a big problem. Right? This whole regulation area is definitely a big problem. Yeah, and so the question was around like research into or like the different motivations for people. So, and this is what I see as one of the big problems at the moment is that there are, I class 6 or 7 different reasons why people get into meditation or mindfulness. So, like I said before, like clinical anxiety or clinical mental health issues, performance, corporate, general stress, all these different reasons, very very different reasons. But at the moment, they're being met by 1 or 2 different types of intervention. So it makes no sense that Rory McIlroy should have the same experience as someone who has depression or clinical depression over a number of years. And so this is where the need for innovation is to create specific products that match those different motivations. And that's what I hope. I'm involved with this all-party parliamentary group mainly as a sort of friendly agitator, and that's the sort of the thing that I'm really hammering them with is we have to all this research into conditions is great, but we have to do R&D into delivery model, otherwise we won't take the advantage. Any more questions? Don't know why I just said it like that. Just to say, this is my email address if you want to email me and get I can give you an iOS version of the app. What else?
I put up some links to your various places up on the main course.
Great. And if anyone's like genuinely interested in the work we do and the area, do get in touch. We have we've got a really busy year ahead, and there might be opportunities for getting involved in certain projects and stuff. So, happy to talk to people about that in the future. Thanks for having me.